Following program is paid for and presented by John DeMasi. The opinions expressed are not those of Town Square Media or station advertisers.
WPG Talk Radio 95.5 presents Talk with a Purpose. Join the conversation by calling 407-1450. Now, the host of Talk with a Purpose, John DeMasi.
Hour number three, Talk with a Purpose, every Saturday, 9 till noon, WPG Talk Radio 95.5. I'm John DeMasi. Nice to have you with us here as we continue our series, Fighting the Opioid Addiction. And we do that with our partners, Recovery Centers of America. We're pleased to have back on our show Trish Caldwell. Trish is the Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming for Recovery Centers of America. And Trish, I guess, you know, you should come on more often because last time you were on, now you got promoted.
That must be it.
Yeah. So what is your new title?
The new title is Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming.
Okay. And we'll get into that and what that means and so on. Yeah. We'll get into that.
Absolutely.
You know, we've had others on the show and we've talked about the opioid addiction and the alcohol addiction. And being that your title is Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming, how important is family in this whole recovery process?
For me and for everything that I have seen in the 27 years of my career, I think family is one of the most critical elements to sustainable, long-term, meaningful recovery. So, you know, I identify family as whoever has your back when you leave our facility. We know that the transition from going from an inpatient with the continuation of care can be difficult and challenging for a lot. And so having as many people supporting an individual as they go through that journey becomes incredibly important in the recovery process. So family to me is, overwhelmingly important. And I think when we look in the side of the families, they are oftentimes the unsung, quiet sufferers of this disease, oftentimes marginalized in the opportunities for them to participate and understand how this has impacted them, how they can support recovery. And so there's a lot of shame and stigma that is certainly associated with the disease of addiction. But I think for a lot of families who have lost their voice and kind of are brought into the darkness of this disease, there's a lot of shame and stigma for them too, trying to figure out how do I do this right,
you know,
and how do I identify ways to support.
You know, I was thinking about this, you were coming on, and I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of people in addicted, whether it's alcohol or drugs, and they got there because of lack of family. So what do you do, or how do you adjust the treatment protocols when there's not a lot of family around, or maybe they're here and the family is across the country? What do you do about that?
Sure. You know, I think so there's two different pieces to that. So there's certainly a lot of times that somebody comes in and their family, they don't live with their family. They might still be involved. And so, you know, we still bring in families, even if that's not where you live. So across the country, we've had family sessions with somebody that was living out in England, just to create that connection in regards to what recovery looks like and feels like for a family to begin to heal. But we've also worked with patients who have come in and for various reasons have no connection to their family of origin. And that's really where that messaging becomes important of family is whoever has your back when you leave our facility. So when somebody comes in and they do not have a family member, if somebody came in and they were homeless, if somebody came in and all ties had been severed, then that conversation still becomes incredibly important to us because it then becomes a part of our responsibility to connect them to our alumni. So we have a really robust alumni programming. So we might connect them to our alumni. We might reach out to the community to see about sponsorship, to get them connected to our spiritual advisors, our 12-step facilitators, because we know that people have greater rates of success and recovery when they're supported by people that understand the disease. So if it is not by a blood family, then certainly we can help to strengthen the resources and build their family support, even if that's internally through our own alumni And we've done that, which has been very helpful, is connecting somebody to the recovery community, even while they're in treatment with us.
I imagine, Trish, that with today being a virtual world, if the family is across the country, that may make it a little easier. Do you kind of try to hook them up virtually in different sessions with family? Do you do something like that?
Yes. So, you know, it's an interesting thing because everybody, I think, over the course of this last year, you know, we've looked for these little moments of light where we were like, you know, in the midst of all of this craziness in regards to the pandemic, you know, what have we found and what have we learned? And I think one of the things that we have learned is this virtual format to be able to continue to do family sessions, for people to recognize this is a platform that they can stay connected to somebody that might be across the country or across the world. So in RCA, yes, we do family sessions that are virtual. We have family visitations that are virtual. Certainly meetings and telehealth have opened up opportunities for people to access and get treatment. But that has been something that has been really positive in regards to that is, you know, I think, again, prior to the pandemic, if you had somebody across the country, you just assumed I would just make a phone call, but I couldn't see their faces. And this has really opened up an opportunity for people to realize Zoom and WebExes and all of these opportunities allow you to stay connected even when you're farther apart.
If you've just tuned in, Trish Caldwell is our guest. She is Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming at Recovery Centers of America. And Trish is here. And if you have someone who you think or you know has got a problem, whether it's drugs or alcohol, this is a good time for you to call into the show because Trish will be happy to talk to you. 609-407-1450 is our number here in the studio. 609-407-1450. Again, it's our Fighting the Opioid Addiction series, our partners, Recovery Centers of America. You know, I was thinking, Trish, you ever like lay in bed, you start thinking. And when we started this series 5 years ago, when I was talking to some of the powers that be at that time at RCA, I said, well, we'll do this for a year and hopefully the problem will be solved and we won't have to do it anymore. And here we are 5 years later, you know, not saying that we don't like having you on the show, but it's like this problem, it seems to be getting bigger. Is that a fair statement, Trish?
Yeah, that's a fact. So, okay. And particularly in light of the pandemic, is that where we are today is worse off than where we were a year ago. So we are seeing higher rates of overdose that we have seen. You know, I know. So I live in the state of Pennsylvania. We saw 81,000 deaths. Oh. So there's an increased amount of what we are experiencing because of this pandemic. The pandemic makes the disease of addiction ripe for it to kind of continue and expand because of the isolation, because of the stress, because of unemployment, because of these vulnerable factors that increase the likelihood of somebody then experimenting or developing a full-blown substance use disorder. So, yeah, I think unfortunately what we're seeing is opposite than I think what we all wish. And that's that it's an increasing amount right now. I think it's important to have things like your show that continue to shed light on this, create opportunities for conversation to let people know that they are not alone, and that we continue to be there for them in a way that helps to support recovery. And I think it's more important today than ever to continue to have this conversation.
Okay, so now that you're Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming, and given what you just stated, What's being done? What is RCA doing? Keeping that in mind to try to help this problem. I mean, you're doing everything, but can you focus on maybe one or two things that you're doing to fight the exacerbation of this opioid and alcohol crisis?
I mean, I think one of the biggest things that we've seen and we have been able to successfully move in the direction of is telemedicine. So I think that's probably one of the greatest things that has come out of this pandemic is an opportunity to recognize, because prior to this, we were really not able and in a position to be able to treat substance use disorder in telemedicine. And today it's really opened up a platform to meet somebody where they are, to get them involved in treatment opportunities, to connect them from the moment that they go into an inpatient. And that's what we're doing at RCA, is to connect them to this virtual format so that we are able to reach all individuals and be able to access treatment for them that's going to help them with the meaningful, sustainable recovery. So I think that's probably one of the most important things that we've seen in regards to, treatment and what we're able to do for those that are suffering from the disease of addiction and their families. I think the other thing that we do is we're doing a lot of support and education. So we have recognized, and so kind of in the same line of telehealth, is creating opportunities. So for me, you know, everything that we used to do for families was in person, which there's still value to. But what we've noticed is that we're reaching a lot broader of a population by doing everything virtually. So every Tuesday night, I offer virtual education for our families and our community members. And we're seeing higher amounts of individuals that are participating because they can do it at home, because they can do it while they're cooking their dinner, because they can do it and still be present with their families. And so it's really opened up an opportunity. So we're really kind of reaching into the community and making sure that those that maybe would have gotten lost because they weren't necessarily ready or able to get in person are still being reached and treated. So I think those are probably the two most important things that I've seen. Certainly, we're doing education. I think the conversation about alcohol use disorders is really relevant right now, because I think, again, while we are still managing this epidemic in regards to opioids, what we're also seeing is a pretty significant increase in those coming into treatment for alcohol use disorders. And I think that's, again, another direct correlation to this pandemic.
Oh, absolutely. I understand that you're involved in a lot of training for RCA and getting your staff up to speed. And I know you do a lot of that and you go all over the country and speak. But can you take one piece of information from all that training that kind of tells the emphasis on family and how important family is?
Yes. So I do a lot of trainings within the organization. We also have like RCA Academy, which trains nationally for any providers or community members that wish to engage, and we do that. There's typically about four different topics each month, and we are doing that as a free service for anybody, again, both in the profession and in the community that wants to learn more, offering continuing education credit. So we're really trying to be a part of the solution by creating opportunities for professionals to learn and grow within this field, right? So wanting to be kind of a community partnership. I think when I speak a lot about the families is one of the topics that I address. The consistent messaging is kind of that meaningful recovery starts in the context of where someone is living. So we are an organization in a field that oftentimes think that the recovery starts when they're with us. And so really spreading that message of recovery starts in the context to which someone lives. So healing from the family can oftentimes be that bridge to beginning the recovery process. If a family doesn't understand what recovery looks like because they only know the language of addiction, it's difficult for them to know how to support themselves and their loved ones. And so getting people to recognize we are in a position that our ability to be able to reach out to these families and help them to understand this disease as we would any other disease. If your loved one was diagnosed with diabetes, somebody would help you to understand what do you need to do differently? How do these foods impact your loved one's diabetes? And that's really what we're trying to do within the families for substance use. Treat this with the same dignity and respect as any other disease, and educate and inform and support families so that they can figure out how to support themselves and their loved ones better.
What I got out of that, Trish, is does any member of your staff, do they kind of visit the family? Do they kind of do that so that they know what the person who's addicted, what they have to go back to when they leave the umbrella of RCA? Does that happen?
So we can't, and especially not right now, but we don't go into it. So we're not a wraparound service. So there's wraparound services and other community-based programs that can go into the home.
Okay.
That is not something that we do. But by involving the families, we have family questionnaire where we ask the families to participate and answer questions regarding the environment that they're going to be living in and where they are in regards to their own recovery process. By having consistent conversations and contact with the families, which is the expectation at RCA that the families would be involved from the first day, it allows for us to have an understanding of, you know, so what will the environment look like? And there's times that for the family's sake or the loved one's sake or both, that we might recommend a recovery house, that we might look at opportunities for sober living, because this is such a traumatic experience for everyone that it is an appreciation that in this moment, while the family is still a vital piece, that the individual recovery programs can sometimes be just as important. And so it's not to say that their family is not good for them or that they don't love each other. It's that a recognition of sometimes the best healing can be when there's a little bit of distance where they can get sustained and consistent support on both sides. So the conversations allow us to really see what is going on in the home and how we can support the individual and the family kind of moving forward once they get discharged from us.
I would think, Trish, that in particular with how thorough RCA is, that if you think a patient needs a recovery house, you would recommend that easily because you did all that work and now you don't want them to go back and then be back to you within, you know, a couple of weeks. That's kind of what I'm thinking here. So is that a fair statement?
Yeah. You know, I think we want to look at each case and kind of identify, you know, I was actually at one of our sites just recently and I kept saying, you know, our job is, you know, our patient is recovery. And we're always staying within the lane of recovery. And so sometimes that means having conversations to say, these are some of the things that we see and we want to support recovery and we want you to heal collectively. But what we want is to kind of stay within the lane of what works in regards to recovery. And that sometimes does mean, but I think, again, the importance to that is really involving the families, because when we don't share that information with families, they can feel hurt. They can feel betrayed. They can feel confused. And so in the same way that we would any other disease, in saying that somebody needs to remain in a hospital or remain in pretty intensive treatment, it's really critical for us to be able to involve the families in these conversations so that they don't see it as a slight to them or a betrayal, but really as we're staying in the lane of recovery and we want you guys to heal together, but these are what we think is in the best interest today.
Okay, we're coming up on a break. We're talking to Trish Caldwell. Trish is Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming for Recovery Centers of America, as we continue our series here on Talk with a Purpose called Fighting the Opioid Addiction. And we have plenty more to talk about with Trish. And if you have a question, whether it's about someone you know or about yourself or whatever, don't be bashful. This is a good time for you to call in because Trish has a lot of experience and has a lot of information at her fingertips on this kind of thing. 609-407-1450 is our number here in the studio, 609-407-1450. It's our Fighting the Opioid Addiction series with Recovery Centers of America. I'm John DeMasi, coming back with more with Trish Caldwell after these words. Back here on Talk with a Purpose with our Fighting the Opioid Addiction series, the number, the 24/7 hotline for Recovery Centers of America, 1-800-RECOVERY, 1-800-RECOVERY. And we always tell you, that's 24/7. They answer it right away. If you have any kind of a problem, whether it's you think you're addicted, you're not sure, you have a loved one, you want to get some help, that's what you do. 1-800-RECOVERY, 1-800-RECOVERY is the number. And again, 24/7 hotline for Recovery Centers of America. Our show is Talk with a Purpose and our series Fighting the Opioid Addiction with our partners, Recovery Centers of America. Trish Caldwell, our guest, Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming. You know, Trish, listening to you during the first segment, I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if Trish ever sleeps. Do you get any sleep?
I do. Not as much as I probably would like or should, but I do get a good night's sleep. But there's a lot of work to be done. So I think we've got a lot of committed individuals.
That's what I thought. And I heard you say Tuesday night. Are there programs every week? I mean, like you said, Tuesday night. I mean, are there things going on? Maybe not you conducting them, but other people. Can you give us an idea?
Yeah. So We actually did, right? And so some of them, and most of them are me, especially when we're talking about the specifics to the families, because of that significant need. So every Monday night, we offer education regarding kind of when somebody comes in under the idea of like a detox only. So helping them to understand what that means. We certainly recommend, you know, longer lengths of stay because it shows greater success. And so we want families and loved ones to be informed and educated in regards to what that means and what that should look like. So, you know, we provide Narcan training on Monday evenings as well. Tuesday evenings, which is predominantly led by myself, we offer a different educational topic every week that directly impacts families and substance use. So the brain and the disease model, the anatomy of a reoccurrence, communication, boundary setting, wellness, the journey to recovery. So every week, it's also an opportunity for people to ask questions. We do a Seeds to Recovery, probably one of my favorite things that I was able to create at RCA was our Seeds to Recovery program, which was a weekend-long retreat at some of our facilities. But in light of the pandemic, we moved it to a virtual format. So on the third Saturday of every month, we have this platform where we do and have different speakers. So on average, I'll have somewhere between 6 and 7 speakers from 9 to 12. And they'll speak about different topics. So again, somebody can share their own story and how their families and themselves came into recovery. Education is provided. There are those that talk about the 12 steps, spirituality, gratitude, you know, how to support somebody, understanding boundaries. And so really supporting families. On Thursdays, we just started this year offering something specific to the families of young adults. So that is also led by me. Predominantly, I'll have guest speakers. And then we've started providing education for families on medication-assisted therapy, which I'm super grateful for. We've got a lot of devoted individuals, and our medical directors have all agreed to be a part of that. So while I'm on that call with them, it's actually our medical directors from across all of our sites that provide that education to the families and communities and answer questions as we go through this, because we know that that's also an incredibly vital part of the continuum of care for some. So really robust kind of family programming to make sure that people are not alone with this.
Yeah, that sounds good. And you said a lot there. So I'm wondering, is this all information on your website?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
So if they went into our recoverycentersofamerica.com and you typed in family, it'll take you right to our family webpage. And there's additional resources. We have local family support groups. Hope Sheds Light, which is local to New Jersey, they're on our website for their family programming. And so we have just additional resources, books and apps that we would recommend for families. So, yeah, really trying to make sure that those families don't feel alone.
Well, typical RCA, you got all the bases covered. That's what I would expect. We have a caller, Trish. Let's go to the phones. Lillian is in Pleasantville. Lillian, good morning. You're on with Trish Caldwell from Recovery Centers of America.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning, Trish. I have
Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I have a question from a long term back. I lost someone very close to me. My question, I'm trying to word it the right way. What are the long term effects on the brain? I saw this person turn not cruel, not angry, but their feelings about caring, their feelings about people, that they don't seem to feel anything. Is this the long term, even if they stop drinking? I know you're not a doctor, I realize that, but I could never get an answer to that question.
Well, and I think, you know, so I'm sorry for your loss. I think the question, you know, it's a complicated answer because the disease itself is selfish, right? And so when somebody is actively using, and sometimes that's where we get caught in that, you know, is this who this person is today? The disease itself is selfish. The disease itself is going to need, in order for it to really be successful, it needs to push away the people that they love the most, right? Connection and re-engagement is kind of the kryptonite to the disease of addiction. So in
that
act of addiction,
permanent?
The individual looks, it doesn't have to be permanent, no. And that's really where recovery is, right? So there's sometimes, depending on substance of choice, there can be changes that occur to the brain as a result of the substance. Again, depending on substance of use and severity and how long. But the brain is an incredibly, beautiful part of who we are that continues to evolve.
It's everything. It's everything. The brain controls everything. Okay.
Correct. And so we see people that when they're in recovery, that it heals and they can reconnect to their loved ones. But I will say, in the past, that wasn't always a focus, right? Recovery also seemed to feel like it was selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And today we recognize the connection, you know, people feeling connected with one another is a huge part of that healing process. So when somebody's in the recovery, we do see them change back into maybe a different version of who they once were, where they feel and can find compassion and love for somebody. But it can be a process, and it can take some time. But again, that brain is incredibly adaptive to the experiences of the environment. So it can. How long it would take, again, might be determined based on severity of use, drug of choice.
Okay.
I hope that answered it a little bit.
All right. Good. Lillian, thank you for the call. Thank you.
You
for the call. Appreciate it. 609-407-1450. That's our number here. If you got a question for Trish Caldwell, whether you know someone or it's you or you have a friend or whatever the case, certainly she'll be happy to give you some information here. 609-407-1450. As far as your training, and I know you conduct a lot of speaking engagements, especially to first responders, and they're obviously on the firing line too. How important are they in the addiction process, Trish?
I think, you know, this is a time that I think we need to spend much greater attention to those that are attending to us. And so when we are looking at the impact that this is having on our first responders, we're seeing pretty significant impacts in regards to substance use and their mental health. So I know at RCA, we are, you know, committed to making sure that our first responders are being taken care of. And we are seeing an increase in those because, again, they were being put into a position that not only were they a first responder, they became an essential employee that early in this pandemic, where there was a lot of uncertainty in regards to safeties and the concerns about bringing home something that you worried could ultimately kill your family or your children. There was so much stress associated with this pandemic. We're seeing kind of the consequences and the ramifications for our first responders. So we do have some of our sites have devoted and dedicated treatment neighborhoods that address the needs of our first responders. Their needs can look and are oftentimes a little bit different than just somebody coming in for a substance use disorder, because as a first responder, you have learned to prioritize others before yourself. And so treatment requires them to start to focus in on some of what has gotten them to where they are today. And shift work can increase that. And we've seen that as a pretty significant change in light of the pandemic. When somebody was out, our first responders were having to work longer hours and more shift work, which takes a toll. And so it has increased, particularly a few of the substances that we were seeing an increased amount. So I think, again, what we're seeing is in line with what we see across kind of our entire community, but we're having to pay closer attention to those first responders and devoted care for them. I think we're also recognizing the essential employees is also something that we're paying closer attention to at RCA. So when I say that, I mean our doctors, our nurses, our therapists, our mental health counselors, our substance use counselors, because we are also seeing that they are getting lost in this shuffle as well, because they were also having to be essential employees during a time where it was very unprecedented and uncharted territory. And so those vulnerabilities of the anxieties associated with it have also increased vulnerabilities for a substance use. So those are two populations that we're paying closer attention to and devoting more time to making sure that we're addressing.
Are you saying, Trish, that because of the pandemic, and we talked about that in the beginning of the hour, that the pandemic has really wreaked havoc on the opioid crisis and alcoholism, are you saying that first responders are getting more affected and they're becoming addicted to whatever because of this pandemic? Did I get that out of that?
That is what they're starting to identify through recent research. Yeah, that we're seeing this hit our first responders a little bit differently than we are seeing it in the general community. Because if you think about what it was, you know, we went into crisis as a nation in regards to this pandemic, and our first responders had to continue to do their job, but they're still human beings. And so the experience that they were having that matches what our experience was in regards to how we were going to be impacted by this pandemic, how our loved ones were going to be impacted by this pandemic, they still had to put everybody else in the community first. So there was no time for them to be able to process what it was going to be like for them facing something that they, although they are first responders, they did not know they were signing up for a pandemic. And that is a significant shift. So I've done a lot of speaking engagements for our police officers, for our firefighters who are being called out and having to go into people's homes in the midst of a time that they were worried about their safety, our EMTs, right? So there was a lot of impact on certain populations because they were still being asked to do what they signed up to do, but at a time that they didn't know they were going to be signing up to do it in that.
Boy, you know,
so we have seen that.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about, you know, we talked on this show a lot about teachers and about how they were worried about going back, and no one ever talked about first responders or supermarket workers or people that worked in Walmart.
Correct.
And you're telling us this, and I believe that you've done the research, and this is really very sad, you know. And I hope, well, I know you guys are you guys are good. You'll get to the bottom of this, but it's just a shame, you know. It really is a shame. This whole thing really threw everything out of whack, you know. But we are, Trish, coming up on a break, and we have plenty more time to talk to you here on the show. It is Talk with a Purpose, Saturdays 9 till noon, WPG, Talk Radio 95.5. We continue our series, Fighting the Opioid Addiction, with Recovery Centers of America. Trish Caldwell today here on the show. She is Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming. And if you have a question for Trish, good time for you to jump in here. We have some open lines, 609-407-1450, 609-407-1450. Coming back with more with Trish Caldwell from Recovery Centers of America after these words. Back here on Talk with a Purpose with our guest, Trish Caldwell, Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming at Recovery Centers of America. The toll-free hotline, 24-7, 1-800-RECOVERY. 1-800-RECOVERY is the number you call anytime. And I'll tell you, I visited the recovery, the center, the call center one day, and I spoke to Mike, who's the supervisor there, and I said, how quickly? He said, well, we don't like it to get to the second ring, so... They answer right away, 1-800-RECOVERY, 1-800-RECOVERY for Recovery Centers of America. That's the number, 24-7. Our number here in the studio, if you have a question for Trish Caldwell, Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming at Recovery Centers of America, 609-407-1450, 609-407-1450. Trish, you and I spoke yesterday, and we were talking about Atlanta County Sheriff Eric Scheffler. And I did send him an email, and he said he will be contacting you. He appreciated the contact. So
wonderful.
You'll be working with the sheriff as you you expand your network, okay? I wanted to ask you, how often does your staff, and I would think now this is probably more important than ever, how often does the staff get retrained in light of the fact that so many things are changing and so many things are happening, especially in the last year?
I think, you know, that becomes a really important piece for everybody to kind of understand that this is an evolving profession and we want to continue to educate and support our staff to be able to be current and up to date in regards to how and why we are doing what we do. So at RCA, we do a lot of training. We have various trainers on site that help them to support kind of their day to day. We also have clinical team members that provide trainings in-house for our clinical team members that are on site, that offer continuing education credits so that we're keeping our clinicians up to date. I know I do a lot of those for our on site. Every month we do internal. So we have RCA Academy that we do for the nation, that anybody can participate. And then we have what we have been calling RCA Academy 2.0. That's an internal. And every month we change the topic. We have some of our experts. So we have one of our MAT CEOs doing some education for our team members this month. So Dominica is going to be offering those trainings in-house for all of our clinical team members that are mandatory. I have done one on family engagement. We'll do them on trauma-informed care, which is a huge one in all of our sites. So that I do predominantly by myself is train all of our sites in trauma-informed care. How do we understand what trauma looks like in an individual that's coming to serve, that we're coming to serve? How do we see how trauma is impacting the family and understanding the family's behaviors? So that's a huge part of us as RCA and an organization, is to make sure that our team members are informed and educated in what trauma looks like, how it would present itself within our patients, so that we can learn better ways to respond to somebody in the midst of a crisis. So it's an incredibly important piece to what we believe in within this kind of field, and how RCA is supporting that mission.
You know, Trish, it's no secret that those who are addicted, whether it's alcoholism or drugs, whatever, it's no secret that they don't think they are addicted, and it's a problem for families. We all know that. That's very obvious. What can you tell, or what kind of programs do you have to get families to convince the one that's addicted that they need help? And we're not talking intervention, because that's the next step. But how do you get them to help the family member believe that they need help? Is there anything in your training or in your programs that addresses that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think that's probably the first time that I've ever had that question is, you know, how are we helping families? Because, you know, denial is a pretty profound symptom of the disease of addiction. And so while we acknowledge that it might be a part of an individual's experience, we oftentimes minimize that it also might be the family's. So families might find themselves, and if you are listening on this line and wondering about somebody that you love and not really sure exactly what's going on, when you find yourself making an excuse for the reason the behaviors exist, it starts to become an opportunity of saying, what are you worried about? And how do you share your concerns? Because this is the only disease that, again, the disease is going to protect itself. So if your loved one is active in it, it's going to deny it. It's going to push you away. It might look angry. It might look sad. But as family members, to be able to share the concern, to share what you see. So instead of being like, I can't trust you, I don't want to do those things, you know, we encourage families to just say, share what you see. I'm worried about you. I notice that you're not coming home at the same time anymore. I'm noticing that you're slurring your speech when we're about to sit down at dinner. I'm noticing that you keep falling asleep and it doesn't look like you're sleeping. Like, share the concern. Let them know that you love them, but that you believe that they might need to have additional support and help. It is scary to ask for help. It is scary to love someone that you think might need help. But when people do, people recover all the time. The disease doesn't solve itself. That's the unfortunate thing. I think there's so much negotiating for this disease that people are like, if I just do this differently, or if I just do that. And when I say to families, would you think you could negotiate somebody out of diabetes or cancer?
No.
You wouldn't.
No.
But you would grieve it, and you would share what you see, and you would say, I know you're afraid to get treatment. I am too, but I believe in you, and we've got to do this together. I love you, and I love you enough that I think we need to ask for somebody else to help us. That's like the first step, right? And the serenity is, I think that's where we support families, is to acknowledge the fear, to acknowledge the grief, and then to say, people recover every single day, but this won't fix itself. It's just not how it works. And the earlier we intervene, but that piece of like how to share what they see, because it's so emotionally driven, because it's so fear-based. So there's a lot more conflict that can happen. I don't want to say anything to them because I don't want them to get angry and I don't want them to use. They already are. And so the disease is where it's going to become angry. And so continue to share what you see. Continue to reach out. And for families, we always say, continue your own support. Gather ways that you can ask and share what you see with your loved one. Call RCA yourself. Families can call us, and we can help to have some of the conversations with them. They don't have to do this alone. We have just as many treatment advocates that answer for families when the families are saying, I don't know how to do this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And our treatment advocates are just as compassionate to the families as somebody that's asking us for help and treatment.
Yeah, Trish,
so I think we all have to kind of partner together.
Absolutely. I wanted to touch on the fact that, and families tend to give up quickly. You find that to be the case? In many cases, they give up quickly. This is an ongoing process, and you just got to keep, trying. That's what I have found in my experience, is that you just got to keep doing it. And the classic is your founder, Brian O'Neill, with the 8-day intervention. Mm-hmm. He never gave up. So is that kind of what you see from families, that they give up too quickly?
Well, and I think, you know, I don't know if I think that it's that they give up. I think it's that fear starts to consume them, right? And because you want to believe. So when somebody tells you, I can do this, I don't need to do this. You know, the thought of somebody having to get treatment, the thought of somebody having something and being diagnosed with a chronic illness is scary. And so those interventions, you know, and Brian O'Neill doing those, you know, those longer interventions is not because the family gave up, but because the family doesn't know and they're living in a fear-based state. And so when people feel heard, connected, and they understand, people tend to make better decisions. And so when we continue to support families and loved ones, and honestly, there's no difference with the way that if we approach the families in the same way that we approach somebody struggling with a substance use disorder, through kindness, compassion, and education and support, we see the same outcomes for both. They're both just experiencing the symptoms of this disease and the trauma associated with it. They just are experiencing it a little bit differently. So those interventions are, again, kindness and compassion and education and support and guidance. So I think, you know, I don't know if I think that families give up. I think in the light of like fight, flight, or freeze, which is the fear response system that we all have, some families get caught in freeze.
Yes.
And they're not sure. And our job is to try and help them to get to those spaces.
Exactly. We are coming up on our final break of the morning. We have a couple minutes left of the show, and you got time to call in if you have a question for Trish Caldwell. 609-407-1450. Trish Caldwell, our guest, Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming, Recovery Centers of America, as we continue our series, Fighting the Opioid Addiction, here on Talk with a Purpose. Again, the number in the studio, 609-407-1450. With Trish Caldwell, I'm John DeMasi, coming back with more after these words. Back here on Talk with a Purpose, our guest, Trish Caldwell, Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming at Recovery Centers of America. 1-800-RECOVERY is the number. 1-800-RECOVERY, 24/7 hotline. You call them at any time, and they will answer the phone right away if you have a problem, you have a question. 1-800-RECOVERY. And again, we mentioned the website earlier, recoverycentersofamerica.com. You heard Trish talk about a lot of the community programs and things that are happening all the time to help you get educated. You just go to the website and you find a program that you'd like or you want to attend. RecoveryCentersOfAmerica.com is their website. And we do have a few minutes left of the show. If you have a question for Trish Caldwell, 609-407-1450. Trish, I always like to get a perspective of what the rest of the country thinks about us. I know you go to a lot of national conferences on this issue. What have you found out about how we in New Jersey compare to other states in handling addiction? Are we up there? Are we good or what?
You know, I think you've got two amazing facilities in the state of New Jersey. When you talk about, you know, our Lighthouse facility and our Capital or our Raritan Bay facilities, I think we are doing innovative work. Lighthouse has the Flex program that's allowing individuals to come into treatment and continue to work in a capacity that would allow them to stay focused on the recovery, but also engage in their job so that those two things don't conflict. We're still doing evidence-based practices. So, I mean, I think that New Jersey is doing a lot of really wonderful things, and our treatment providers are really offering, you know, cutting edge evidence-based practices and really trying to address the need. So Raritan Bay, again, with the development of their first responders programming, I think New Jersey is And I will say I'm born and raised in New Jersey, so I always have a soft spot for New Jersey, even though I don't live there now. I think we're all learning how to make sure that we continue to evolve to address these issues. And in light of a pandemic, RCA has picked up a lot of pieces to kind of figure out what is the next best way to be able to do this. How do we keep people connected? How do we get them involved in alumni? How do we utilize something as wonderful as telehealth and telemedicine in order to be able to support long-term recovery? So, you know, in the compare and contrast of, you know, all of the states that I end up speaking at, I think, you know, New Jersey and our sites at Raritan Bay and in Lighthouse are doing a pretty amazing job at,
well, I'm glad to hear that,
meeting this disease where it is.
I'm glad to hear that because, you know, New Jersey gets a bad rap. So we got a good rap. That's good. We have a caller
sure does,
here, Trish.
I'm not going to ever be a part of that.
Okay. We got a caller. Mike is in Northfield. Mike, good morning. You're on with Trish Caldwell.
Hey, good morning, John. Thank you for the informative program that you have. And a question for the clinician. What does she feel is going to be the impact of legalized marijuana in New Jersey? You know, because it seems like that's what the people wanted, but it's going to be another intoxicant thrown on the people, the 21 and older. And I just wonder, you know, her thoughts on the actual impact of having that drug available.
Okay, Mike, thanks for the call. And it's a concern of mine, too.
Yeah.
Trish? Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
I mean, a great question. So, I mean, again, I will say I'm a treatment provider. And so I'm not a fan of any legal intoxicant that increases the access for somebody to begin using a substance as a coping skill. So, you know, and I think we've seen that. So financially, is there going to be a financial benefit to legalizing marijuana? Yes. There is a significant difference between legalizing and decriminalizing. And so those are two different conversations. And so the legalization of marijuana, again, I've spent a large part of my career working with adolescents. I think we are going down a path that could potentially increase a lot of risks for a lot of individuals. So I'm not a fan of the legalization of marijuana. I think that there's opportunities to decriminalize something so that we're not making sure, you know, we're making sure that we are not having disparity across treatment and ways that we're incarcerating individuals. But the legalization, and I think we've seen it in the states that have legalized marijuana, we have certainly seen statistics that
not
have been
good.
Reflective of the consequences, the increases of DUIs, the decrease, you know, college completions have had higher rates of dropouts, high school, while everybody says they're 21, you know, it's a different conversation. So sitting across from an adolescent and having a conversation in the developmental brain and an adolescent increasing their risks of using marijuana significantly increases their risks of addiction further down in their lives. So I think we're going down a very slippery slope when we start to kind of say these are things that we should be legalized.
Trish, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for coming on. Trish Caldwell, Vice President of Family and Clinical Programming, Recovery Centers of America. Remember that number, 1-800-RECOVERY, 1-800-RECOVERY, and the website, recoverycentersofamerica.com. Trish, we look forward to you coming on next time. Maybe you'll be president by then, you know?
Yeah, you never know.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
All right, continued success with Recovery Centers of America. That's going to put the wraps on another edition of Talk with a Purpose. Thanks to Trish Caldwell. Thanks to Chris Coleman, our program director and producer. And thanks to you for listening. We certainly appreciate it. Have yourself a great week, and we'll do it all over again next Saturday. Talk with a Purpose, 9 till noon, WPG, Talk Radio 95.5. I'm John DeMasi. You take care.